Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome, and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 59 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week. We had actually quite a lot of announcements, other than, you know, everyone's still reeling from the letdown of the last episode being aired last week. So, it's been a hard week, I think, for a lot of people, getting prepped for what's to come. But we did have a birthday this week on the 4th of October. It was Katrina's birthday. And did you see the Twitter thing between her and Sam?
Oh, yes, I did. I saw that really late in the day. Oh, I did see it, but then Tobias's kind of reply was the best. And I won't repeat it.
No.
We did retweet it, and I basically said, "Et tm ad cb dicit," which just means in Latin. And so Tobias Menzies says to Katrina Balfe. And I just retweeted his thing. It was very funny.
I think what's almost more funny is imagining Sam trying to type this cute little tweet and not putting a space where he needed to put a space.
Granted, it was risque, but it was adorable. It was very sweet. It was definitely meant with love and meant with friendship.
No, it was funny. It was so funny. And I could just imagining his face when he realized what it was.
I'm usually funny without trying to. No, I have never done that before.
The difference is that you delete them. He doesn't. He's like, you know what?
That is true.
He's like, I have 80,000 followers and I'm pretty sure they've all already seen this. So there's no point in my deleting it. I'll just leave it there and follow it with an apology.
That is so true.
But it was so funny. Outlander has started teasing again.
Well, they never really stopped.
We're barely a week out from the last episode that we're going to see until April. And they're already showing little teaser trailers. Now, I'm glad that they're little teaser trailers.
Oh, yeah, like 29 seconds
like
or 22
snippets,
seconds. Yeah.
So they're not going to be able to give too much of plot or anything like that else away. It's just
or
more
change.
Of a, right. And having read the books, that scene that they keep showing could have happened in several places.
Yeah.
So I'm not exactly sure when it falls, but we'll have to wait and see till April. And Diana, on CompuServe, mentioned that the second half of the first season is going to feature voiceovers, but that these voiceovers will mostly be from Jamie.
Which is world-rocking.
It
rocks my world in a very good way. It's very interesting, but it makes sense.
It does make sense, because if you've read the books, you know that a lot of the stuff we don't see on screen or in the book, and it's something that he tells about. So it might be using that as a device to allow you inside of Jamie's head. We got a few Instagram pictures this week. We got another Hey Lassie. And this one is Sam and Katrina looking into each other's eyes lovingly, and it says, "Hey Lassie, want a kiss in the rain?"
Which, cute.
I don't know anyone who would say no.
If presented with the question like that, I think someone would go with, "I would kiss him on a boat. I would kiss him next to a float. I would kiss him, blah, 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 Sam I am." I mean,
okay.
It would be
green eggs and ham.
Yes,
I got you.
Exactly.
Okay, Dr. Seuss.
What a silly, silly question.
She did. And they also got us a picture of Katrina with her horse. Do you remember her horse's name? Was it?
I forget.
Was it Thistle?
I think so.
Something. It was something like that. Anyway, I remember.
And I love that.
It's a beautiful bridle.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
Did you see what she said? She commented
no.
on it on her page. She said, I love that bridle, although it wouldn't be very practical for use in jumping and English writing.
Oh, yeah.
Which is totally true, but it's beautiful, like the leather work. And then we also got a shot of Dougal with Hamish playing around in the yard. Looks like he's trying to teach him how to be Superman.
Or something.
Something with his little wee stick. Everyone's smiling, just obviously a behind-the-scenes shot of them playing in the courtyard. And they've also announced that among women 25 to 54, the Outlander mid-season finale averaged 0.7, making it Cable's number one original series Saturday in that demographic.
And all I have to say is,
Well, yes, and?
Exactly. Yeah, and?
And then this last bit of information, it's only a surprise to me because I would have thought this would have already been taken care of. Diana Gabaldon officially signed the deal for the 9th Outlander book, which we all knew she was already working on it. I guess I just assumed that because she was already working on it, that it was already like something.
So are you telling me that Dr. Gabaldon was working without being paid?
Yeah.
I just thought of that.
Yeah.
We are very happy for her because if she's kept happy and paid very well, because she does a lot. I mean, yes, she's talented and she does the research and she works very hard, but she produces wonderful stuff. Hmm. So I'm very happy she is compensated the way, especially now, the way that she is. I hope that the ideas keep flowing.
But could you imagine?
No.
Could you imagine if she was still writing this ninth book? She's already talked about writing it. And then all of a sudden her publishers are like, you know what? We're good with eight.
No.
We're good with eight.
No, because the publishers, and I mean this with love, there is money involved.
Yeah.
And there are millions of fans. And I'm not saying the fans are owed anything, and I'm not saying the fans rule the world. But if the fans are still willing to purchase tons of things, right? Mm-hmm. I'm just talking books. I'm not even talking the TV series. I'm just talking books. If we had no more Outlander, I would be sad, but we had the books. Fans will buy many, many things, books in many formats, and as long as she keeps, I think even outside of her Outlander world, I would still be a fan. But the publishers aren't going to say that. I would hope that they would defer to her as long as she's got something to say, and as long as the characters still have stuff to say, that they would bring forward an offer.
That is that.
And now, on to our read-along.
Can I just say how excited I am? Dragonfly and Amber Summer.
I know.
Summer.
I mean,
summer.
You know,
a year ago.
But not even
It was bloody heck.
Not even that. When they announced that they picked up a second season.
Oh yeah, of course.
At first, I was like, just one. But then I was But then I remembered. I'm like, this is a really good one. I feel that way about each successive book as they come out. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is a really good one. So I think as the seasons progress, each new one that I'll get will be exciting, just as exciting. But
always.
I don't know, coming off the first season, the second season pickup is really exciting for me. But this week we are starting at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
We should start with the prologue. I love the prologues because they're always kind of like this nebulous first-person narrative where it's... For me, it's obvious that it's Claire, and it's from Claire's point of view, but it's never attributed to her and never really, like, attributed to any specific person, even though when you read it and you know the story, it makes complete and total sense. And this was a lovely prologue leading into the biggest whiplash WTF moment in the history of Diana Gabaldon's book
so many
far.
Of the comments we got were every single person who said anything and who gave us anything. Every single person mentioned WTF.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I've introduced a lot of people to this book series. And
every
introducing
single one
to them,
comes
every,
back to curse at her.
Every time they hit book two, they always come back at me and are like, I don't understand what's going on. Did I miss a book? And I was like, no, you're on book two. Stay with it. Just keep reading.
This might be a good place. You know, I wonder if knowing the shapes of the novels or the shape of a novel you're about to begin would actually be helpful. I don't think it would hurt, because the thing about the shapes is, because Diana didn't really see them until after she finished, probably wouldn't help going into it, right? Because to know the shapes, you have to know what happens, and that's not something that you can see.
I don't think that it would affect your read if it was the first time through to know the shape.
Well, if I told someone, okay, it's a dumbbell, they're going to be like, again, WTF. It
no,
means
for sure.
Nothing.
No, for sure. But it means something to the readers.
After the fact.
The people who've read it.
After
Absolutely.
The fact. That's what I'm saying. So Diana didn't realize or recognize. She could have recognized it when she was in it, but she definitely recognized it and could fully explain it once she was at least solidly in it, if not finished.
Yeah.
But yes, we can always, always recommend the very first question of our Diana Gabaldon interview, episode 49. She took about 15 or 20 minutes to explain the shape of every single one of her big books. And God bless you,
Dr. Fascinating.
Completely
fascinating.
That was probably one of my favorite things.
I still go back and listen to that.
That was one of my favorite things I've ever heard her say anywhere. Because we've heard her, I wouldn't even say tease, we've heard her mention the shapes and describe some of the shapes. A good number of them. Well, one or two or three. I've heard up till Voyager or something. But the rose and I'm like, seriously? Yeah. There's no, and the tsunami wave.
Yeah.
Hello, Kitty. How random is that? Well, it is kind of random until you recognize the story and hear her explain it.
Well,
it's so fascinating.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like, until she says them, and until you, and if you hadn't read them, it wouldn't make any sense. But once you've read the books and she says them, you kind of go, huh, I can totally see that. I totally get
it. And we're here for chapter one.
Absolutely. Okay. So, but we'll start with the prologue.
The prologue. So it's interesting that you say, and I agree with you, that the prologues are always, always, always interesting. Remember the one for Outlander? It's basically people disappear all the time. Mm-hmm. And they generally are found. Very ominous.
The thing about this prologue for me is that the first time through, it kind of makes no sense.
If you stick with it.
However.
If you read it a few times.
On the second time through, knowing what comes. Like,
oh, I see what you're saying. You mean after you've read the book once?
Yes.
Got it. I thought you meant the first time through the prologue itself.
No.
Absolutely. Because you really do need to read the entire book to know what this is.
And that's how I feel about the prologues for all the books. Because if you go back after you read the book and then you read the prologue, it makes so much sense. And then they're all a little bit like chill bump inducing.
And so, I'm glad you said that. Because knowing that the prologue, the meaning of the prologue will fully hit you upon finishing the book, book, I may not want to break it down as I was going to.
Okay, then let's not do it.
No, I'm going to break it down, but not the full way.
Break it down.
Okay.
Oh,
I'm a loco.
No, I was going to go with Hammer Time.
Yes, it's from that. It originated. Okay, so small tangent. I studied music, and we had to memorize the church modes. And I use that. That song, right? The one you were just doing?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, whatever.
Hammer Time.
If anyone wants to hear it.
Can't Touch This.
Can't Touch This, sorry. You're right. I remember that. I use that basic tune, basic rhythm to help me memorize the seven. And I know there are, I think there are seven. There could be more, but anyway, people will correct me, I'm sure. The church modes, Dorian, Phrygian, Lydian, Mixolydian, and so forth. So anyway, I use that song to... or the chant, kind of rhythm of that song, to memorize the church modes. But I digress fiercely. So, to a small, not complete, breakdown of the prologue.
Basically, it's like three paragraphs breaking it down. Yeah, but shouldn't take more than a couple sentences.
No, but we can't break it down completely because...
No, well, you can't break it down with information that the casual listener doesn't know.
This is the way I did, and I will not say my interpretation of the final one, right? She says she awakes three times. The first time in sorrow, quote, with tears of a bone-deep loss that woke her. And she says, of grief remembered. This, to me, is significant or reflects after she first went through the stones.
Yeah, I thought this was an echo back of the first
missing
book.
Missing and losing Frank.
Yeah.
Going through the stones in the first book.
Yeah.
The second time she awakes, it's with joy. And I have a lot of quotes here. So the joy of being, the joy of being with Jamie, quite frankly, because it's from the first book and that's totally known now. I quote, I came awake in fierce joy, body arched bow-like in the throes of physical joining, the touch of him fresh on my skin, dying along the paths of my nerves as the ripples of consummation spread from my center. I repelled consciousness, turning again, seeking the sharp, warm smell of a man's satisfied desire in the reassuring arms of my lover, sleep. Now, besides the content of that and whom I believe, or we believe, she is talking about or speaking of, who has not had a nice dream? It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be this kind of dream. Who hasn't had a dream who kind of wakes up or half wakes up and is like, no, I want to go back to sleep.
I have had this like running commentary with people who have known me for a long time that I don't have detailed naughty dreams. And I don't know if this is because of my upbringing or what, but I always have the fade to candlelight dreams. I feel like I'm always cheated out. Like, as soon as, like, something's getting, like, hot and heavy, it's like, wake up, Summer. You can't have this dream.
Now, without being specific, the third time she wakes up, she says, in solitude, she woke alone, beyond the touch of love and grief. Quote, the sight of the stones fresh in her mind. She describes the standing stones on Craig na Dun, and that only she knows their true function. First in sorrow, we agree, when she first goes through the stones, missing Frank, torn from her time and her place. The joy, being with Jamie, which is center of book one, basically, right? Her experience with Jamie. The solitude. We will have to learn what that refers to.
I think it's foreshadowing for what's to come. Because, I mean, obviously it's foreshadowing for what's to come. That's the beauty of these. It's the beauty of these prologues of the things that she writes. Like I said, they don't really hit home until you finish the book.
Two things I will say. I agree with you 100% on the foreshadowing. So solitude. two things, and she gives them out without giving the why or the how. She woke alone, beyond the touch of love and grief. Read whatever to that you want to. And she connected it with the stones.
No, for sure. And that's
all we need to say.
And what I will say about this is that I think that if this is your first time through the novels, always go back and read the prologue
at
the end of the book. Because it will have a whole new meaning to it. It will have a deeper meaning and it'll make a whole lot more sense. So, but that's roughly the prologue. They're always beautiful.
And then we get into part one. And this is where, because at first you're like, oh, that's pretty. That's kind of weird. Is it sad? I'm not sure what she means. And then bam, into part one. It says, through the looking glass, darkly. Okay, whatever. Inverness. 1960 frickin' 8. Yeah. What the heck? And I wrote, okay, what? As a first-time reader, let's talk about this whiplash someone might experience. And yes, you are reading the correct book.
Yes. No, this is the ongoing, it's very common. Like, very common. It's literally everyone I have ever introduced this series to comes at me when they start the second book, and they're like, what the heck?
Yeah.
What is going on?
Okay,
this isn't where we left off.
So, a few comments. From Tweetly D, our friend D. Oh, D has been with us since Outlander. She tweets, I assume you're going to touch on the WTF, in caps, the WTF moment where we all thought we had the wrong book. Winky face. Hashtag, what the hell happened? And then Connie writes, another powerhouse of our commenters. WTF? We just left Claire and Jamie in a grotto in France in 1744. Right. What is this all about? Girlfriend, we all had that question.
No, and Diane, our friend of the show, Diane, she wrote in saying, I remember being so shocked and gutted on my first reading to be back in the 20th century with no explanation that I couldn't really appreciate the details of the scene with Roger. So she had
no kidding.
So I'm sure that on successive readings, she appreciates that whole first chapter more. But I would totally agree. The first time through, I didn't catch anything. I was like, get me through the scene. Get me back to where I need to be.
I don't care who this is.
This is not where I'm supposed to be.
I just want Jamie.
Well, so I do want Claire, but I was like,
No. We want Claire and Jamie.
Roger? I mean, not who is Roger. We all know who Roger is, but it was just like, why? Well,
we may or may not, because it's been a long time since we've heard of him.
Right, and he was wee Roger at the time. So this is a grown
just
man.
A wee Roger.
1968, cleaning out poor dead old Reverend Wakefield's house.
Chapter one, mustering the roll. Connie had made a good point. It had definitely brought some similar imagery to my mind, but she spells it out very clearly. The term muster designates the process or event of accounting for members in a military unit. Okay, we're going to be doing something military in this chapter, right? Very good point. And then she wrote, wait, Roger Wakefield? Who is that? And what happened to Claire's point of view being the guiding force in the story?
Yeah.
Again, it's called Whiplash. Diana Gabaldon Whiplash.
Right. Don't get comfortable in a Diana Gabaldon series.
Book, anything.
Well, not even just in a book, but from book to book, things change. Like,
yeah, of course.
Not the writing style, but the point of views she uses are different from book to book. I mean, if you get too comfortable in a Diana Gabaldon novel, you will be sorry for it.
And if you ask too many questions.
Then she'll kill your favorite character. or leave a 5-year-old in a mine for 5 years.
That's the other author who killed all the Stark. That was
funny.
Did
you see that meme?
Yes, I retweeted. I retweeted his tweet, which was very funny. He said
every time somebody asks me when it's done, I kill another Stark.
Yes, and I retweeted it, and I said, I wonder what writer DG does. Okay, the first words of the entire chapter is the name of a new character. Now, not new to the entire series, but new to being basically a
focal
speaking.
Point for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And it's Roger Wakefield.
But I will point out the only person who ever speaks first person is Claire. Everything else is third person. Mm-hmm. So it does stick with that. So anytime you're in
the
that Claire is.
Unless it's a quote. Uh-huh.
Correct.
Or dialogue, sorry.
Anytime that Claire is the focal point where it is from her point of view, it is first person. Otherwise, it is always third person. So that is something that does remain.
So Roger is in a room surrounded by boxes and room after room of furniture, clothing, and books. I wrote, all the books.
So many
books.
The way that he's describing this, like, he is like the original hoarder. Like
The Reverend.
Yeah, the
not
Reverend
Roger.
Is... No, not Roger. The Reverend was the original hoarder.
Not poor Roger.
Like, if the series had been around when this book came out, that hoarding series from like TLC or whatever it's called, the hoarders, would have been banging down his door being like, let us in, we want to help you.
I can see, because what happens is, Summer and I record, or the two of us and a guest or our interview guest record, and we save it, and I go back and edit it to keep for, you know, in case some naughty words popped out and they really can't be kept, or there's a lot of silence, or someone had to get up and go to the restroom. There is editing that is needed. So I'll go through and I use that second listen or third to edit, but also to listen for things that might make topical or just plain funny or random tags to put on a blog post to tag it. And I think one of the blog posts here is going to be hoarders. I'm sorry, one of the tags will be hoarder.
Seriously, though. And he was a meticulous hoarder. And he seems to have things...
The thing is, even if things don't look nice to us...
There was a method to his madness, you know what I mean? It wasn't... Like, he had boxes. Like, there were just lots of it. Like, yeah. They were all labeled miscellaneous Jacobites.
Yes. But I don't know about miscellaneous Jacobites. That means the people are laying in their...
One of them said, like, Jacobites.
Jacobite.
Miscellaneous.
Comma, miscellaneous. So, we...
Sorry, I'm laughing now.
So, Roger is literally surrounded by history.
Yes.
Our introduction to him is important. He's at the manse, we learn, and his uncle slash father has passed. That's the Reverend Mr. Reginald Wakefield.
You just made him sound like a redneck.
His uncle?
Uncle Daddy.
His uncle slash father. Oh. So, Connie shares... This would have made Reverend Wakefield about 58 years old at the time of Claire's disappearance. She says, don't ask. I just like to do the math. That's awesome, Connie. And then he talks about, because he's so overwhelmed with this, he's just like, you know, getting into his Morris Minor and going back to Oxford. And I actually pulled up a photo of this. And it's a car. It's a 40s car. I think a 40s car. But it looks a lot like, and I didn't pull up the series. And I know we're not talking about the series, but it does look a little bit like the 40s car that they were driving in the series. That's all.
Well, to be fair, a lot of the cars in the 40s
look similar.
I mean, they all have a very, like...
Very female.
A very
sensual,
sexy,
kinda, yeah.
Kind of curvy look to them. I mean, that was kind of indicative of the 40s. Now, I'm sure there are some car aficionados out there. I don't know that they listen to this podcast, but some car aficionados out there who would say, I disagree, cars look very different, but... I think that if you look back at, like, popular culture and movies, 40s cars have a very specific kind of look to them.
So we learn that he had traveled there to the manse from Oxford in the history department. He describes, so this is getting back to the stuff that's around him. He describes a basket of gaberlunzies, quote, badges issued to 18th century beggars by parishes as a sort of license.
I wanted to know if Human Rose was in there.
Oh, gosh.
That's immediately
that's
what I thought.
Think about. I was like, oh, you and the house was full, as you said, of Jacobite artifacts. The Reverend was an amateur historian and loved the 18th century. This was his favorite period. Mandy shares...
It's become my favorite period.
Yep, the same thing. It gives readers an instant flashback to Human Row and One Fine Day from Outlander. I think this is a clever grounding by DG, since readers are a bit confused by being in the 20th century. So, yes, little by little, she's setting... the scene, you know, you're in 20th century Scotland and you know you're at the manse, but she's starting to lay the groundwork, little things that are the Jacobite era around, literally. Another artifact was a ram's horn snuff mull. The inscription on it had names and dates of deacons and treasurers of incorporation of tailors at the Canongate from Edinburgh in 1726. I don't know if that is...
mull, is that something that you put snuff in?
That is, yeah. So what I was going to say was, I'm not sure if the inscription is important, but I included it anyway. And if you guys think it is, or something from the Canongate at Edinburgh or 1726, please let us know. We'd be very curious to hear that. But Connie comments, a snuff mull is a snuff box, typically small, to fit in a pocket and supposed to be airtight and used to carry snuff.
Correct. Now, it made me think, I mean, that's totally an era thing, because that's not something that you would pass down from, like, deacon to deacon in a church nowadays. You'd be like, oh, I'm going to engrave this now that I'm passing the deaconship on to you. I'm going to engrave this with your name so that you have all the... Nobody passed on snuff boxes anymore or, like, cigarette cases. I mean, that's just not something you would do today. So that's very indicative of the era.
We find out that the Reverend had adopted Roger, or we're reminded that the Reverend had adopted Roger when he was 5 after his parents had been killed in World War II, his mother in the Blitz, his father over the Channel.
Now that was made more specific than we'd gotten in the previous novel,
I believe.
Yes, that's true. I think that it was just... previous...
That he was an orphan.
Correct.
Or his parents had been lost in the war, something
so
like that.
So this was way more specific, and this would be something that will definitely come back later.
And just as he is wanting to do anything but go through his parents' things and the Reverend's things, the doorbell rings, saved by the bell. The woman standing at the door is described as middle height, pretty, and she had fine bones and a wealth of curly brown hair, and a pair of light eyes like well-aged sherry.
Now, I knew exactly who it was when he said curly hair and when it was confirmed when they said sherry, but... I knew that going into this, I'm like, it better be Claire. I'm like, because that's, I mean, I need somebody from my last novel who was a main focal point. I need to get me back on track. Get me back to where I was. I want to be back in the grotto. I want to be back on my way to France.
Summer has only one thing on the mind, and that is the grotto.
Well, because we leave her.
And there was a little bit of a hint of a bebe.
A hint? It was pretty It was not a hint.
But there was a bebe.
Okay, that's not even how you pronounce it, spell it, or anything.
That's how I spell it. Not pronounce. That's how I spell it.
How do you spell that?
B-E-H-B-E-H. Bebe. That's not what I just said. Earlier I said bebe. Anyway.
I'm so confused. Okay.
A baby.
My point is, I know.
A little human.
I know. Oh my goodness. But my point is that when we last left them, they were in a grotto in France. She was pregnant, and they were off to, like... create some sort of espionage and try to stop the uprising. So why the F are we back in 1968? Yes. So she better be the one at the door.
So she knows Roger already and introduces herself as Claire Randall and says she hasn't seen him since he was 5.
Which made me sad.
I know. Because all the time...
She's not Claire Randall anymore. Not to me.
Well, yeah. So she says she knows that the Reverend had passed. Connie also, I mean, we already knew this, and yes, I read it when I read through the chapter, but Connie points out, and I wanted to include it, we also learn that Claire is a doctor, a physician, which is very important because she's still in healing, she's still in medicine, that's not changed, but she's done a lot more now. She's gone to medical school, but we learn in this chapter that she's a physician.
Which I think there's a lot of things went into the decision, I think, to throw them back, or throw them forward, in time and to leave that out, because nobody wants to read an entire book about going to medical school.
Oh, no, yeah.
Because I think that it was important that she become more knowledgeable because as a character, I think that those having that knowledge is more important and it drives a lot in her character to have that important
skills.
And it
gives her more importance and more authority in the field.
Well, and it makes her so much more...
authoritative.
Right.
And an expert.
Agreed. I just think that as a plot device, throwing them forward in time like this had several purposes. It allowed her to be more educated and a doctor now. It allowed for a lot of things that I think are boring for some readers to read to have just gone. I mean, as a parent, I think I'm totally enthralled with, you know, the day-to-day care of babies because I did that. But I think that as a reader, I don't always want to read that. And I think that that would have probably been less interesting of a choice than to have, boom, they're grown up. And I think that Diana does this several times in the series. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
So, lamenting about how many things there are for him to go through, Roger then hears an American voice say, "In that case, maybe we shouldn't be disturbing you." Then Claire introduces her daughter, and Roger was wondering when he'd changed his shirt last. Sounds like someone is trying to impress or feeling something about someone else. And this is a first. I put 3 stars. Doesn't matter. 1 star, 2 star, 3 star, but asterisks, whatever. Brianna is her name. And she is 6 feet tall. That's what Roger guesses by where she lands next to him or how tall she is.
I'm like, as a person who's 6'3", not me, Roger.
It's like, since when?
I would think that if somebody comes up to his eyeballs, he's fairly sure that she's got to be at least 6 feet
exactly.
tall.
Exactly. And Connie comments, "So, is this the baby that Claire was carrying at the end of Outlander?"
Right, huh. which is the first thing.
Which
that
is
comes
what
to
you
mind.
Think. We have no evidence that it is or isn't. We have no evidence against it, right? All we know is it's her bebe.
Oh my God! Stop saying just that. Say baby.
All we know is that it's
child.
It's her child.
Any other word?
It's her child, and it has. Well, we don't know anything else except it's a girl, and she's tall. So that is actually a huge, pretty huge hint. Claire says that they'd meant to come, but hadn't been able to. Some things had kept them. But on this trip, they'd been doing some sightseeing. And then we get the hint, the next observation. Brianna has thick red hair, strong, sharp-angled bones in her face, with a long and straight nose.
So basically,
that's number huge hit over the head. Number two,
that this is obviously a child of James Fraser.
Starting to look like Fraser.
So now I did want to point this out. Diane sent in and she said, "I love the first glimpse of Brianna. How is it pronounced?"
Claire pronounces it Brianna.
Brianna.
That's all we're gonna say.
Okay. So Brianna. So she says, "I love
just
the
like
first,
an American word, Brianna.
Okay. I love the first glimpse of Brianna and Roger's self-conscious straightening up to match her height. I imagine him with a scholarly youthful slouch, and so I know the feeling of being caught unawares at home in your comfort zone and then being confronted by someone you'd really like to see you at your best." So just, and I love that whole scene of him inviting them in and him standing up straight and then having to duck because he almost like hit his head going through the archway.
Now then she says she was born in America and her mom and dad were English. Claire explains that Frank Randall, her husband, had died 2 years before. We find out that Frank was a historian, or reminded that Frank was a historian and a good friend of the Reverend's, and that's very important.
Well, the second she
and
says,
they'd discussed Jacobite stuff for years.
No, and the second she says Frank Randall, Roger goes, "Oh, Frank Randall! I know what you're talking about."
Claire asks Roger about, quote, a small historical project. She needs someone knowledgeable in Jacobite era history. Bonnie Prince Charlie, etc. And so she gives him a list of names of 30 people that said Jacobite Rising, comma, 1745, N dash, Culloden. Maybe an M dash, I'm not sure. I gotta check that out. Connie comments, this actually took place in, Culloden was actually in 1746, in point of fact. The Rising started in 45 and came to a bloody end at Culloden on April 16, 1746. That's absolutely correct. So Claire wants to know how many people survived the battle. Claire says that she has been to Culloden, although a long time ago. We learn that Culloden was the last uprising and that many Scottish Highlanders were slaughtered at this battle. Those slaughtered at the battle were buried in the grounds there. Roger notes Claire's beautiful hands and a ring on each. Silver on her right, a wide Jacobean band in a Highland interlaced pattern embellished with thistle blossoms.
This made me think of an addition. I know we're not really talking a lot about the series, but it made me think of an addition to the series that was made with Frank drawing her hands. Which I didn't...
Oh, that's interesting.
I didn't ever think about her hands as being anything out of the ordinary during my first readings of these... First and subsequent readings of the series. But because it was something that was added to the television series, it made me think about that when
and
I read it.
And here we have evidence of at least one person admiring her hands.
Yes. Admirable. Her hands.
So Claire's list had names of some men. Was it on the same list or another list that it had names of their wives?
I think it was all one list. She only gave him one piece of paper.
Okay. So Roger then gets them some whiskey. Claire drinks hers neat. Of course she does. And Brianna, even with lots of soda, barely sips at hers. She's not a...
She's like me.
She's like you. No, she's not like coughing up a lung.
Well, she also wasn't really drinking it.
That's true. So all the men on the list, Claire tells us, or tells Roger, came from the same estate, a place called Broch Tuaroch, also known as Lallybroch, part of Clan Fraser. Roger agrees to help with the project. Of course, he cannot. There's a few reasons.
Well, I mean, he wants to do what he's doing, right? It's avoidance.
And there are two pretty ladies he doesn't mind helping. And he loves history, so.
And he admittedly wants to get to know Brianna better. Brianna.
It can't hurt, also, he relates, that some of his father's boxes were labeled Jacobites, comma, miscellaneous. Yeah. So... it's kind of a good all thing coming together kind of. It would be fun. I think he sees it as fun and easy.
Well, and I
fun
think
and quick. Interesting.
Fun and easy. Something other than what he's already doing that he doesn't want to do. And also, it would probably help him to go through those boxes with a purpose as opposed to just having to go through the boxes to try to get rid of stuff.
I just saw a quick tweet from at Stephanie in SD. She says, at Tweetly D and at Outlander Pod, this made me laugh. I read it years ago and had that reaction back then. And Tweetly D goes into her reaction again. Spent the entire book going, what happened? Why? When? Why? Just more, we all understand. We all understand.
To a degree, when you bring that back up, is that I feel like it almost follows the first book in the fact that once you've read it before. You spend the whole first section going, okay, get to the stones, get to the stones, get to the stones. Whereas with this one, it's kind of like, okay, get back in time. Let's figure out what happened. Get to the point where you're telling us what happened because I need to know what happened. You thrust us into another time zone.
No thrusting.
Not yet. Give it time.
So Claire then mentions Druids, the local group that she and Frank had seen dancing at the Stone Circle in their visit in 45. Mrs. Graham, the Reverend's housekeeper, had been one of them, and we learn that Mrs. Graham had passed since, and that she has a granddaughter, Fiona, who is 19. And Claire does want to speak with her, but she's not there, so she'll have to make another visit.
I have a lot to say about Fiona, but we haven't met her yet, so I'm going to keep it to myself.
That sounds good. So then it was very sweet that Roger notices that Brianna is biting her fingernails. I think he finds it endearing because when he sees that, he says it gives him kind of the courage to basically go on and make sure that they can make another appointment or date or set up time to meet again before they leave. It gave him kind of the courage to make the next move, if you will. And he mentions the stone circles, and as he suggests going there on his way to Brock Turach, Claire suddenly knocks both the whiskey glasses with her purse onto his lap and thighs. Connie writes, Claire, accidentally on purpose, spills whiskey all over Roger. Exactly, Connie. So even though it says she is obviously flustered, I don't think it was on accident. She was flustered because of what he was saying, not because she did the whiskey.
I don't think it was on accident per se.
No.
But
she may have been startled.
Correct. But when Brianna comes back and says, I honestly can't believe they let you perform surgery on anybody, it gives me a little bit of an inclination that perhaps she is a little touchy and twitchy.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where we learn that she is a surgeon, which is also important because it's a whole... all MDs are surgeons.
And that's a whole new level of doctoring.
Of expertise, exactly. We don't know what kind she is yet, but... So Connie writes, Brianna is embarrassed of her mother's clumsiness, and we learn that Claire is a surgeon while Brianna is trying to clean up the mess. This is, as you said, Summer, leading to an awkward moment when she is cleaning Roger's pants. Roger suspects that Claire did it on purpose, but can't think why on earth she would. So yes, Brianna tries to...
But I love this scene because she says, he's like sitting there trying to think of anything other than the fact that her hand is getting closer and closer to his crotch, to the point that he's just like, you could just see him in your mind's eye bracing himself as she's like drying his pants off. And then all of a sudden she's like, I think you got the rest of this.
So Brianna nicely tries to mop up the whiskey from his shoes and his pants. But then when she reaches his nether bits, she lets him take over. And here he notices her deep blue eyes. So if you have not gotten all of the hints and signs yet, it's Diana has done almost everything. There is at least one more coming up, which we will point out. So Claire tells Brianna that she wants to get in touch with an old friend who had an interest in witchcraft, old beliefs, and folklore. So when I first, especially after coming out of that scene, from that scene with Roger, I'm thinking Mrs. Graham. But then,
I didn't.
I did, but then I'm thinking Mrs. Graham, but then we find out that she's at least been partly thinking of Galus. Connie writes, Bree changes the subject to, what did you think of Roger Wakefield? And then she writes, aha, in a sing-song voice, Bree likes Roger, Bree likes Roger. So Brianna describes Roger's eyes as groovy. And of course, what is that, especially the way I say it, what does that make you think of?
I mean, it's definitely indicative of the time period.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, groovy baby.
Oh, like Austin Powers?
Something like that. Okay. So yes, we are definitely in the 60s. I love the conversation between Claire and Brianna when she describes his bum and just gets her going just to keep laughing. And it may not have been directly because of this. I think it was a very cute little scene. But part of me thought, you know, here's a mom with her daughter, a widow, a young girl who has lost her dad, the only dad she's ever known. Only father she's ever known. And she loved her father. Well, this is not a spoiler. She loved her father. She loved her father. So even though there's no mention of Frank right here and it's all about Roger, to me, it's just something maybe a mother would do just to keep her child in, you know, in laughter, to keep continuing this moment.
Oh, I do this all the time.
Yes, but not just that, but also, and it may not have been top in her mind, it's just another thing, what I thought of, and it may not have been the intention of Diana at all. What I thought of a little bit was, again, too, because even though this trip is not necessarily about Frank, the connection that, to almost everything they're doing has a lot to do with Frank, and he's gone. And so I think part of it was her being just a mother, but also to keep her in that funny, light, banter place and not have sad thoughts about her dad. Just in it, so it just doesn't go back there. Even though he wasn't even the topic of conversation right there. I appreciated that.
I didn't even think that at all, to be honest.
I just appreciated it a lot.
As a mother, I do that crap all the time with my daughter. If I get her going and laughing, I do whatever I can to make it keep going because
it's funny.
There is nothing funnier than like outraging your kid or like embarrassing them or like whatever it is, just to get on their goat and just
stay there.
Yeah, and just keep it going as long as possible. It's all I do. Like, for instance, my daughter currently has no front teeth because she's lost the two front teeth.
And those are the only two she's lost.
No, that's not true. She lost the bottom two as well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Those are already back in. But yeah, no, the top two front ones. And I probably do this two or three times a day. I'll walk in and go, "Hey, babe, where are your teeth? What did you do with your teeth?" And she's like, "Mom." And I'll keep it going for like at least a few minutes before she finally has had enough. But I will push that envelope because I think it's hilarious.
Mandy writes, "I love the part where Claire notices Roger's bum and Brianna says, 'Mother!'" That just gives such the perfect picture of a mother and daughter. It always makes me smile. I agree, Mandy. It tickles me as well. So they're getting ready to go to Loch Ness. And Brianna asks, "Think we'll see the monster?" And Claire replies, "You never know." Because Claire knows there is one, at least sometimes. So we get another hint at Roger's attraction to Brianna. Rather than tackle the task of packing up his father's belongings, he wanted to start the research project and bring the results to Brianna, to her feet, quote, "to go round to Mrs. Thomas's guest house and lay his results at the feet of Brianna Randall, as knights were supposed to have done with the heads of dragons." She reminded him of a Bronzino painting. Bronzino was a 16th century Florentine painter of Medici patronage. His portraits influenced European court portraiture. He was a mannerist, which is about a style that is basically art about art, style for style's sake. According to Peter Schieldahl, if I pronounce that correctly, in his article for The New Yorker, Bronzino portraits could exude aristocratic hauteur and erotic glamour, and his renderings of women tend to be generic masks of beauty, devastatingly so, in the, quote, "Head of a Smiling Young Woman," circa 1542-43. And we have a link to this sketch.
Diane sent me a link to the blogs, like a blog spot that had a bunch of Bronzino paintings, which was good because I was thinking of doing it and then I slacked and didn't do it. I think
Connie gave us two.
but
you know,
she did email it to me, so I hit the link. So I'm looking at it right now and I totally get it.
So this type of sketch was used as a study for his elaborate frescoes in the chapel of Cosimo's Spanish wife, Eleonora di Toledo, in the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence. And this article is entitled "Venom Now, Bronzino at the Met," from The New Yorker, and we'll have a link to that in our post as well. So Roger decides to put off the task of organizing up the Reverend's things and to go to Culloden House to begin his research the next day. He forgets the paper and goes back to retrieve it and places it in his breast pocket, Diana writes, just over his heart. And I thought, I just love that little touch.
Well, and he gives kind of this like casual, like, "just so I don't forget it tomorrow." I'm keeping it with me now. Just because I don't want to forget it tomorrow.
So Claire and Brianna have been to Loch Ness and they return to their guest house, the B&B, and Brianna goes to bed. Claire describes the books that she's brought with her, intending to donate them to the local Inverness library. She describes them and she says, or Diana writes, "Here was evidence or result of her late husband's life work in these volumes. Compact, weighty, authoritative." Quote, "not bad for a life's work," she thinks. And she goes to Brianna, who is sleeping, and Brianna smiles in her sleep. And Claire whispers to her sleeping child, "God, you are so like him." She has said this before, but she says that she only says it to her when she's asleep.
Well, of course.
And that's the
last big confirmation. Yes. Look, we all know what Frank Randall in the books looked like. He was not a very tall, strapping, redheaded man who would beget a very tall, strapping, redheaded, beautiful child.
And we never get any description of him smiling in his sleep.
No, that was, if we needed any other further documentation that this was Jamie Fraser's daughter, this was it.
Pretty much.
But then she juxtaposes that by saying she's also, after yes. looking at Frank's life's work, she's like, she looks at Brianna and says, she's not bad for a life's work either.
Mm-hmm. It says, not bad for a life's work either. Maybe not so compact, but damned authoritative.
I love that.
Oh, Mandy.
Because she's always, Brianna is always described as like.
Strong.
Strong, large. And by large, I don't mean fat. No, by any tall. Means. Just like a very tall, strapping woman. And she's not mannish. And she's, but she's not like, she's never described as being like overwhelmingly gorgeous. Like she's not like.
Classic
beauty. She's always described as being pretty. Like she's always beautiful, but it's never like the classic beauty of like, you know, like an Aphrodite, like everyone has to look at her. Like she's looked at because of her height and because yes, of how strikingly hair. How striking her hair is and how strikingly tall she is.
Mandy writes, Brianna smiling in her sleep when touched. This is just the final layer in DG making obvious whose child Brianna is. At this point, the first time readers are dying to know what happens. I remember the first time I read it, literally reading as fast as I could.
No, I totally agree with that. And Diane says, and of course, the moment when Bree smiles in her sleep just seals the deal. I hear Diana's voice so clearly in the passages where Claire talks about her daughter, and those moments are so tender and sweet.
Oh, Lord have mercy. Not giving anything away, but holy mosey and a biscuit. When there are many times in the books when Claire talks about her daughter, Claire writes to her daughter, Claire does different things to her daughter. She loves her, obviously.
Does different things to her daughter.
Okay.
A weird phrase.
Speaks of her or Thank writes you. To her.
I'll take it.
And just from Outlander, if you made it through Outlander, you know there's some, you know, difficult times in Outlander. Sad times, happy times, all that. Those are themes that will not go away in any of her books. So that's not a spoiler. It's just the way it is. However, some of the most touching things I've ever read were words from Claire to her daughter.
You know, and I think that...
And they're almost hard
I
to read.
I think that it... No... Definitely Claire to her daughter and also Jenny to her about her children and about and those things.
Yes.
A lot of people write about being mothers and about what it is to be a mom and how it feels and all of the emotions you have. But I don't think that unless you've experienced it firsthand that you fully understand it and can put it into words like Diana Gabaldon has. And you can tell that she is a mother when she writes these things because you can tell that she's writing with a layer of experience and not just, this is how I imagine it would feel to have a child. I think that she's got a whole nother layer to it when she writes about her children and about Brianna and any of the mothers in this series talking about their children. Mm. You can always feel that there's more than just words, that there's experience and
can I just tell you, I'm
it.
Gonna need my own, like, I think I'm gonna have to go to a hotel and bring some wine or some champagne. Whiskey, I probably wouldn't be able to drink enough. But I'm gonna have to bring something, get my own darn hotel room or something when that prequel, whatever book comes out about Ellen and Brian. Private yeah. room. I need some me time for that. That is gonna be an emotional wreck of me. Is that too much? That's too much.
No, I mean...
Is that too much spoiler?
No, it's not a spoiler.
Well, from Outlander, we know that they're gone.
Okay, look, it's not a spoiler because you don't know what it is yet, and no, it hasn't been written, so no, you can't spoil it. And everybody knows that Jamie's parents' names were Brian and
two,
Ellen.
And in book one, we already know his parents died.
Well,
there's no
we
secret.
Also,
that's
okay,
what I'm trying
but
to say.
We also already know, as podcasters and podcast listeners, which I assume we have that are listening right now, that there is a prequel being written. This is something we've discussed before. So the fact that there is a prequel being written.
That's not a
surprise. So saying that there's going to be a spoiler, a prequel.
No, it wasn't.
Is not out of the blue.
No.
And isn't spoilery.
Saying that there's a prequel is not a spoiler in any way. What I'm saying is neither is saying that her parents are dead because we already know it from Outlander.
No, they are. And the only thing I'm going to say about the prequel is that I do not read Diana's quotes of the day.
No,
not I go me. Out of my way to not do it. However, I did read one quote of the day that was about the prequel between Brian and Ellen.
Did it freak you out?
No, it made me immeasurably happy. Like, I read it and I was like, but I'm like, I don't ever want to do that again. Like, I make it a promise to myself and a practice to not read her quotes of the day because I want to go into each new novel totally unspoiled and not having any kind of inclination.
I can't even make a comment about the one time I did read one before Moby because we're only on book two now, on chapter one. I can't even say what I read because it was from Moby, book eight. Okay, so we learn, she says, she talks about it being an April, a Highland April night or a Highland April. So we learn that it's April. So the big thing she's there talking to Roger to get help with is about this battle that was in April of 1746. And now we're in 1968 and it's in April. So I just noticed that. Same type of weather. Same thing.
So as a random question, is there a solstice coming up?
For us?
In the course of the book, is there like a
solstice? I mean like
one of the big
fire days or whatever?
Yeah.
Fire feasts? Beltane.
Beltane.
May 1. Claire goes down to the sitting room. And alone, enveloped in the quiet of the Highland night, she pulls out a copy of a list she'd given Roger. She has her own copy of one. She didn't even need it. She already had the names memorized, basically, from so many. She's known these since whenever she first got them. The last line was eerie and beautiful. And speaking their names as though to summon them, I began the first steps back, crossing the empty dark to where they waited.
I got
hello chills.
I know. I got the impression that this was something she maybe did a lot. Like it might
be a ritual
that she did.
Maybe it helped her go to sleep.
Right.
Who knows?
It almost reminded me of like somebody with a rosary.
Mm.
You know where they sit and they do all the prayers that you do with each successive and you count them. I imagine with the rosary you count so many whatevers. Are you familiar with the rosary? I'm not.
I know that it's decades and it has like an Our Father and a Hail Mary and
there's like a count like but you use them as like a counting mechanism I think for
yeah, what you're it's, doing. A decade is 10, so it has like the main thing, and then it has like 10 little beads I think are for the Hail Marys. And then there's another bead where you do some, it's based on mysteries, like the joyful mystery, sorrowful mystery, different things that are totally 100% biblical based, but it's different parts of the story, different parts of the life of Jesus.
Yeah.
When he's born, when he's sorrowful, obviously, when he's probably on the cross. So it's biblical, but it's almost a form of, it is repetitious. It's almost like a meditation. It is a meditation.
Right. And I got the impression that this scene, this almost list, like was her rosary. Like, almost like this was her new religion. Like, this is what she did every night to calm herself down, to get herself, to center herself, to prepare herself, that this was all leading towards something.
And that's where we don't know what it is, what that something is yet.
No.
But I'll say it again. To summon them, I began the first steps back. Now see that, okay, so you could read it one of two ways. The first steps back, as in the first steps back to whatever she was ultimately trying to do, or as a routine, the first steps of her routine, however often she did it, was this. And crossing the empty dark to where they waited. These are ghosts.
Of course.
Are people. Here's the thing. Or at least
of
her ghosts.
Of course they're ghosts.
So.
That is how we end chapter one.
That was a pretty deep thing. Technically, there's probably some deep stuff in any chapter that Diana writes. But I guess the biggest thing is that the prologue is pretty deep.
Yeah. They always are.
And the chapter was full of a lot. And we had a lot of kind of side conversations, which I think is important for this first chapter and probably the first maybe 5 or 10. I don't know. I'm sure we'll address the whole whiplash. Let's just call it whiplash. I'm sure we'll address the whiplash issue again. But yeah, I think that was a pretty nice read along.
I think it was a good way to start.
DIA. Oh my gosh. We're back to what we said in the beginning. I can't believe we're already there.
Even though I hate where we start this book. For, you know, several reasons.
Well, you hate it because it's not where we left off.
Agreed. Even though I hate this, it's how I feel about the beginning of Outlander. It's the penance. Mm. It's the penance you're forced to work your way through to get to the meat of the story. So it's important that we all go through this together. So whiplash be damned. Let's all hold hands and kumbaya around the campfire for this.
While Claire summons her ghosts. Yeah, you probably are sick of me saying this, but
always
this, thank you for that. This is my favorite book. And right now you're thinking, whatever. Right now it's meaningless because we don't know what's happening yet.
Okay.
But once we get to the end, my guess, 95, if not 99, because I think there's at least going to be 1% that kind of gets it. Not that you're not smart, but that you would agree with me in some capacity. My guess that 95 or more percent of you would completely disagree with me that this is their favorite book. This is my favorite book of the series.
No, I understand because I know you as well as I do.
And we can't say that yet.
We can't say the reasons. No, I won't. I understand why this is your favorite book of the series. However, which also would make me think that you would understand why Voyager is my favorite book of the series. So that wraps up our read-along of Chapter 1 of Dragonfly and Amber. It's taken about a year to get here, but I'm so happy.
Just over a year. Yeah, and I mean, welcome to October. Thank goodness
I'm so glad to have a reason. I'm so glad to have a reason to be able to continue this read-along.
There's a reason for our season. So thank you so much for joining us. We had commenters. We got a lot of emails, and we could not put every single thing in our read-along, but we tried to splash them in. Splice them in where we could and in our notes where they were relevant. And so we hope to have even more. It's a nice problem for us to have way too much stuff to try and fit in there because we will do our darndest and we'll cut out our own little fluff if we need to. It makes it so fun to have thoughts of others, not just your thoughts on like you read something and we comment the same way, but like your jokes, the way something hit you when you first read it, if you remember that. And a lot of us do. Again, whiplash. So thank you so much for joining us. And we hope to hear from many more of you and continued from those we had this time. Thank you, Mandy, Tweetly D, Connie, and Diane. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
Dreamt it last night that my young